This is Flight Training the Way I See It with Mike Schiffer. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Flight Training the Way I See It. And I'm your host, Mike Schifflett. I was a former pilot examiner for the FAA, currently run CFI Bootcamp. And this podcast is all about opinion and about things happening in the industry. And so it aligns with our newsletter, which the next newsletter will come out in September. So this will be probably early to you. And we'll elaborate on what's in the newsletter each time. So we'll probably have two episodes per newsletter so we can really tackle some of the issues that are going on in flight training right now. So one of the first things I wanted to go over with you is the difference between testing and teaching maneuvers. So this is going to be centered from a flight instructor perspective, just so you kind of get what we're on about. So when I was a DP for the FAA, I did practically every single test you could do that doesn't require a type rating. So I did everything from, well, recreational, I guess, all the way through ATP, and then all the multi stuff, and all the initial flight instructor, as well as CFII, MEI, reinstatements, renewals, those kind of things. It pretty much wasn't anything I couldn't do, except for a single engine ATP, which I don't currently hold. I hold a multi-engine ATP, so you can't give what you don't hold. So there's that. I gave around 3,000 flight tests over 11 years for the FAA, and I always had a strong opinion about the maneuvers that I had to be tested. And almost every one of them was on some kind of practical test, the ones I had in question. I guess, you know, sort of what am I getting at, right? So I have no idea why I need to test ground reference maneuvers. And I've had this conversation with FAA conferences, I've had it with their examiner standardization team, with many other places. And also I was a pilot examiner in the UK as well for the CAA. I also hold British licenses. And so I was doing flight tests there, and there's no such thing as a ground reference maneuver. You don't even visit that subject, really. You talk about wind drift. So anyway, there's no chandelle, there's no lazy eight, there's no weights on pylons, there's none of that. So it's just a skills test. And there are some maneuvers, don't get me wrong, there are some in that test, but basically it's an operational test. So an example, when I did a private pilot flight test called general flying test there, we actually had to make the cross country. And there had to be a diversion. It couldn't be just the first checkpoint. We had to go, I think the distance was 40 miles or so. So we actually had to go somewhere. And it was an operational test of your ability to fly an airplane. And then there was the next segment of it was a diversion. And the next segment of it was the flying skills side. So it'd be flight maneuvers and takeoffs and landings, that sort of thing. So I was always, you know, wondering, like, what is the purpose of testing a lazy eight, a chandelle, turns around a point, S turns across a road, any of those. I mean, I don't see the purpose of that. Those are teaching maneuvers. There are specific things that are in the FAA handbook, which we'll talk about here in a minute, that are designed so that you can give your student practice and give them something interesting to do and develop their awareness of, like, wind. For example, the chandelle is really designed to improve the applicant's sense of timing, energy management basically for the airplane, so it doesn't either have too much energy when you finish it or it doesn't run out of energy but before it gets done. Then it's timing, so that's timing. And then there's coordination, right? And there's just aircraft control, and there's a sense of where am I? So orientation, spatial orientation. So that is a great maneuver to teach a student to do that, but I don't know how valuable it really is on a flight test. No other country has this. I don't know of any country that tests lazy eights, eights on pylon, none of this. These are teaching things, maybe. And that no other country's reference material that I can find even mentions those things. It's sort of centric to us in the FAA land. So as I go on about this whole thing about teaching and testing, you know, I was wondering, you know, why don't we just get rid of those things, those on a test, and test certain things. Like, I think teaching or testing the stall series is important because these are things that you're not going to practice typically on your own. And also they're things that can do a lot of damage pretty quickly, right? So having awareness of that is a good plan. And all the emergencies, of course, because the chances are the last time you practice an engine failure was either on a flight test or it was during a flight review, which are held pretty infrequently. So, or maybe an airplane checkout if you went to a different school or you want to check out a different airplane perhaps. But in general, those aren't things that you're doing all the time. So those are good things to test because those things need to be fresh. And if you go to flight safety and you do a type rating, there are no chandelles, lazy eights, eights on pylon. It's all about the airplane. and it's about having operational knowledge and function of it. So if you ever fly for an airline, you'll get 121 check rides, part 121 check rides, which are basically line checks, and they are checks of you operating the airplane in a sim, going somewhere, following the company's standard operating procedures, in our case, the FARs, for if we don't have a SOP. And then there are some maneuvers. There certainly are. There's steep turns. There's emergencies. There's approaches to stalls, the things that they haven't done in a while either. So, I mean, but it's a very practical sort of test. And it's not, when I say practical test, I don't find Chandelle's Lazy 8-Stage Tail Pilots very practical. I mean, there's no real use for the Chandelle. You know, people call it a box canyon turn, but it is not. So, by the way, just for some background, that's Chandelle means candle in French, and it was originally designed as a 3G pull. So you basically pulled almost vertical, and you pivoted on the tail so you could be slow and get behind someone or get away from someone quickly. That was what its purpose was. And when they first introduced the Chandelle, in the FAA, that's kind of how they did it. You know, that's why it was in the utility category in a lot of the airplanes. Like if you look at the 172N models and you look at the placard that's on the side as you get in, you'll see Lazy 8s and Chandelles are in the utility category. But you would look at them today and say, why would that ever need to be in the utility category? There's nothing special or high G about it. And then the Lazy 8 was also in the utility category. And those were basically wingovers. So those were done at 60 degrees of bank, by the way. So yes, they took a while, but the idea was you flew through the whole thing and you developed a sense of coordination and timing, which they still work for that. But again, I'm on about why are we testing it? Why can't we just teach it? So another few things to say, there's the ground reference maneuvers that are in the private in particular. The 8-ton pylons is sort of a ground reference maneuver, but it's not built for the purpose I'm gonna tell you. So I've asked many people in our CFI class when they come in, what is the reason that we're teaching ground reference maneuvers? Why do we teach that? And a lot of times there's no answer, or the answer is pretty weak. And the answer that I'm looking for, which is the one hopefully you'll have said, is the purpose of teaching a ground reference maneuver is to see the effect of wind, drift, and to stop it. So there's things, maneuvers that are based in there, and those maneuvers are turns around a point. We've got S-turns across the road. We have rectangular courses, and we have all these kind of things. And so those are tools, right? Those aren't, that's not the aim of when you go do those, isn't to be a master of something you're not going to use, like turns around a point or S-turns across a road, right? The idea is so that you can see the effect of what the wind is doing to you and stop it and keep that pattern across the ground track, matching up to what the maneuver looks like, right? That's the idea. So having said that, another thing we need to talk about is prerequisite material. So what I mean by that is, if all you were to do is go to the section on turns around a point, which most people read, and then rectangular courses, 8-ton pylons, whatever it is, one of the things they're not gonna talk about is any prerequisite material that you had to have known before we actually got here. So as a flight instructor, you wouldn't teach turns around a point, S-turns across the road, rectangular courses first. You would teach tracking a straight line by crabbing. You know, you'd pick up a railroad track or something, and you get the point of the idea is you wanna see if the student can see wind drift. And may have to go when it's a fairly windy day, and if that doesn't work, and the wind is sufficient, 20 knots or so across the ground, you may need to slow the airplane down and be pretty low to the ground to be able to see the wind drift, because the slower you are, the bigger the wind drift angle is, right? It's a function of your ground speed. So anyway, that's the first thing you would do. And you would brief it as if, you know, we're a boat going across a river, and you explain that, you know, the boat is not pointed towards going, but this straight line track is going to the dock on the other side, just pointed upstream. So it's the same with the airplane. We need to say, just because the airplane's not pointed there doesn't mean it's not going there. And then we have to see that the student is able to then track a straight line and eliminate the wind drift. And that's what we're on about. And then the other thing we say was, what about when we're turning? So when we're turning, then we have a situation where we really are crabbing by turning. So which is an interesting thing. The airplane flying currently has a lot of errors in it. And a lot of the errors are in the ground reference section because they show the airplane, the airplane's heading on the circle. Like it turns around a point, they show it exactly in line with the circle the whole way around. Well, that's not really gonna be happening. When you're directly crosswind, the nose is gonna be pointed. The ground track, in order to keep the ground track the same, the bank will be higher, that's or lower, depending on the side of the wind you're on, and it will it'll be, the only place it's gonna be on the point is when you're directly abeam it. So going downwind or directly upwind. Otherwise, that nose of the airplane is not gonna be on that circle. It's gonna be either inside of it or outside of it. And in order to get the ground track to work out. So there's a lot of errors in the handbook. So we have to at least say that sometimes it's not our fault, but there's that. And then we would teach the student that we're crabbing by banking. And so the more bank we have, because we're controlling the radius of the turn, right? It's the radius, if that's the thing we wanna keep, keep the same distance around the point, then we have to keep the radius the same. And if that's the case, we gotta do it by changing the bank because we can't slip or skid, because that'd be the whole point of flying is not to do that generally. So we've got that. So I once asked one of the examiner standardization people from the FAA in Oklahoma City, I said, why are these things being tested? And his answer is pretty obvious once he told me, because it made sense, but I don't agree with it, but it made sense. He says, well, you know, when you evaluate a maneuver, that's a very objective thing to do, because there's a test standard. It says plus minus 100 feet, plus minus 10 knots. It says it gives you criteria by which you can measure right away. And that's easy. It's if it's outside of 100 feet or some little bit past that or outside of whatever the spec is, well, then it's not satisfactory, right? Or if it's in spec, it is, right? It's pretty objective. He says, when you're testing someone in a scenario situation, you're evaluating decision-making, risk management, and judgment. And this is very subjective and difficult to score. How do you fail someone like that? You know, what's on the notice of disapproval? The scenario didn't work out, I suppose. You know, it's maybe what's on it. So I kind of get the idea. I just think there are better ways and we're not approaching it from that point of view. I think airlines do it all the time. You know, in 135, they're just doing line checks and doing sim checks and they're doing operational checks every so often as you go. And if you don't pass it, it's because something in the scenario didn't work out. And it doesn't have to be, or you didn't make the right decision. And those things can maybe be argued about, could be. But in general, I mean, I think they craft up scenarios that are pretty hard to wiggle your way out of. So I think we'd like to have some more of those in testing. And if I were doing testing again, like I say, it would make a flight. And we would do things on the way for sure. And we'd do a diversion, but I want to see how you handle yourself on a cross country or some flight that you're going to do. And then something happens, there's an emergency, we go maybe somewhere else, right? And maybe to a non-towered airport if you fly from a towered airport or vice versa if you the other way around, and see that you can have operational knowledge of the airplane and you have enough systems knowledge and emergency and sort of control the airplane to where you can not be a hazard to yourself or your passengers, right? That's the idea. And I don't know what, like what I say, Shando or Lazy has anything to do with taking someone for compensation or hire, but that's that. So there's some other things just to bring out. So I'm topping you off in the right way. And that is to say that when you teach ground reference maneuvers, or you're gonna teach, in particular, let's pick this one, the power off 180 or the 180 degree power off landing. So typically, if you thought you're gonna be tested on that, or you knew you were, or you're studying for it, you probably go to the airplane flying handbook, which is where the information is about it. And that's, by the way, you can go to FAA.gov and it's airplane flying handbook. I think we'll find it easy, but it's a handbook. So it's gonna be FAA-H for handbooks. 8080, it's general aviation stuff, -3B, that's the current one. 3C is ready to go, by the way, but they can't release it yet. So, and it corrects a lot. There were, I think, 200 corrections that went into that, maybe 200 or more. So anyway, just so you know, in my last meeting with the person who was making this, a lot of those changes. So anyway, but the idea is when they talk about this power of 180, I'm sure this is kind of what you do. I'm sure you go directly to the page that talks about the power of 180 and you read it. And that's all you read. Because you already know how to land, so this is just a piece of it, right? But what you're missing is just before the power off or the 100 degree power off landing, there's the power off 90, which is not currently tested. It's not in the ACS or PTS. So therefore, you write it off because you say, well, it's not in there, right? But there's prerequisite material that is in there that does relate to the power off 180. So if you haven't read the section on the power off 90, you're missing about a quarter of what you need to know to really do this maneuver correctly. And there's also the power off or the 360 degree power off approach and landing, which is after the power off 90, and all the 180 and the 90 are prerequisite to that. So the idea here is that there are things that are prerequisite. For example, in the ground reference maneuvers, what I told you before, all that stuff you have to cover before you ever teach turns around a point. And the way this kind of came to me was during a class. It was kind of a, I was teaching how to do a lesson plan. So I think some of you have seen those videos that I've done on that. And one of the things I did was I wanted to construct one from absolute scratch and steep turns. And I went to the airplane flying handbook, and then I read it, and it started immediately talking about load factor, increase of stall speed, VA. It talked about those kind of things. But what was not in there was any discussion at all out of like what it would look like out the window. How it talked about overbanking tendency, but it didn't say that because your seat is in a different place, it'll be a different perspective. It didn't talk about adverse yaw. It didn't talk about coordinating the airplane while you're in the turn for those training tendencies. It didn't mention any of that. And I'm like, well, why didn't it do that? And then that was the part that really dawned on me, is because the student would have already had to have mastered or done level turns first. And that is covered. So if you want to sometimes create a lesson plan that is complete as you want it to be, sometimes if it haven't done something for a while, you have to make sure you've done level turns first. And then also you might want to put some of that content which they struggled with or you're on your steep turns lesson plan, see? So that's any of those things that are more advanced, there's usually some prerequisite stuff that we got to have read. And you might recap that on your lesson plan. I don't know how you want to do it, but in general, that's how that is. Okay, so let's move on. I also want to tell you that you should really get our newsletter, because it's basically, it's a paper version of what I'm telling you with some more detail in it. And it's available at cfibootcamp.com. And if you go up to the very top, you'll see resources. And you click on newsletter and you can opt in right there for it, and we'll make sure you get your copy. Because a lot of times we'll put links and other things in there, some of the stuff's a little hard to find. And maybe you don't want to watch the video all over again, you just want to read something, or you don't want to listen to the podcast. We do a video podcast as well. So there's that. The second thing I want to bring up is how to correctly use a syllabus in a Part 141 environment, a Part 61 environment. So how do you correctly use a syllabus in a Part 61 environment? Over the years, I've watched people struggle trying to use a syllabus in a Part 61 school, because it just seems like that there's an awful lot to cover in the amount of time that's allotted. And then a lot of the times the student is not prepared so for the lesson. So you have to end up doing something different. So in a Part 141 school, they have to use a syllabus, and the student's held accountable to that. And there's usually a ground school. So that's done independently of the flight side. Not always, but usually. And if that's the case, then the flight instructor's job really then is to review the ground portion of what's in the syllabus, but not concentrate on it, and then do the flight side and then grade it out, right? And if the grade out would be any number of grading scales, pass, unsat or incomplete, could be, or 1 to 5, whatever the grading scale is. And that's the sort of limit of the instructor, because the ground stuff has been done prior to the flight. And normally it's done as a complete ground school that is ahead of the flight side. So you're not ever behind on the ground. Or it's completed already, it's been done at a different time, and now they're just starting the flight side of it. And those things can be long. At a Part 141 school, I think 35 hours comes to mind, but there's a number of hours that is required to achieve say the ground is done. All right, so if you have a ground school at your Part 61 school, you could lean on that. That would be pretty good. If you don't, then your other two choices are to give it yourself, which can take a very long time, or it's to use a home study course, and then check the home study course, make sure you trust it, and make sure the student does the work as they go, not just watch videos while they're cooking or mowing the grass outside or on the way to the school, right, in the car or the motorcycle, even worse, or skateboard around here. So you want to be able to hold the student accountable for what they need to do, and also make sure that you're prepared to deliver the lesson in the time that you have. So, for example, ASA's one which we teach in CFI Bootcamp. So we use ASA's private pilot syllabus to pretty much walk people through how you're going to teach someone how to fly an airplane. And then we use the airplane flying handbook. We don't use their book, but we're going to talk about that in just a second, about how you do it. So the idea in this particular case is the syllabus helps keep the student knowledgeable where they are in the process, where they are and what's expected of them. If there's a test to take, or there's a quiz to take, or stage check, or whatever, end of course, whatever it is, that we're all gonna be doing that. And so then what we do is we teach you to use it as a checklist. Instead of following it linearly, what we do is we say, this lesson, in the first lesson from ASA is 2 hours on aerodynamics, And then the next, it's only 1 hour in flight, and there's like four or five things to cover in the flight. So it's not enough on the flight side, too much on the ground side, right? So then in that particular case, we would teach you how to make a lesson plan to say, we're going to split this up into two lessons. And so it's going to be this on this day and this on this day from this first lesson that's in the syllabus. So you can, a lesson plan is designed to cover a single instructional period. So it fits within the syllabus, but we would maybe have one or two or three, can could even be lessons per that amount of time. So that's how we use the syllabus. And then we just use it as a checklist. What I mean by that is as we do things and we're satisfied the student knows, and if they've done the home study course or the ground school, we can just ask them questions about the ground. We don't necessarily have to go into it entirely, and we tick off the box either on paper, on a spreadsheet, or whatever we're using, and say that's done. And then we can, and we, that way we make sure we didn't miss anything. And so I think that's a good way to do that. Use it as a checklist rather than a, I have to use their book and I have to go through the whole thing. You know, this way you can cover everything you need. The other thing you have to be cautious of or make sure to do is to make sure you're telling the student what in the home study course needs to be fulfilled before you show up again, what books need to be read or what quizzes need to be taken, whatever those things are before the next lesson. Because students, when they initially learn how to fly, they're keen on the flight side, but when they get to this ground side, that they're not really thrilled with it, you know? And so their idea is, if I can get out of any of that, I'm probably gonna, unless they have different motivations. But in general, that's kind of what they think like. And you say, well, you know, you're gonna have to understand the aeronautical knowledge because you'll be tested on it, it's for sure. And these are things that you need to know so you can identify risks that aren't really apparent to you. If you didn't know anything about aerodynamics, there'd be a lot of risk there that wouldn't be intuitive. And so you do have to know some things. The extent of what you have to know, I still question, right? It's an ICAO requirement, so if we had a national license, wouldn't talk about it as much, but we don't, so we've got that. So that's how we want to use this syllabus. And I've attached in the newsletter, if you sign up for that, you'll get a copy of the syllabus. So the other thing is, we have a product called Teach Brief Fly. And what it is, it's if you don't know about it, it's basically three parts of the book. Oh, the other thing I was going to tell you before that. There were three parts of the book. Lesson plans, just like you have created or you would use on a check ride, right? And you maybe use with a student. Comprehensive ground lessons is what I would call them. Then the second part of the book are pre-flight briefings, which is basically what you write on the board, a whiteboard. It's got a little whiteboard outline. What you write on the board, and then any artwork on the right-hand side that I actually designed the artwork. So I'm not an artist, so I know you can do it. And that's the pre-flight briefing, what you're going to do just prior to flight. And then the third part of the book is what to say while you're teaching a maneuver, exact words to use while you're demonstrating or teaching a maneuver. So that's Teach Brief Fly instructor version, right? Then there's a student companion guide to that, which basically says, for this maneuver, when you look at it, you look at your syllabus and you says, I got to do steep turn, slow flight, and stalls. You can go to those same places in either book, in particular yours, the instructor version, or the student version, and then a student will know what they have to complete. It'll usually be there's an introduction I wrote for every maneuver, every topic. And then after that, there's go to the airplane flying handbook or the pilot's handbook of aeronautical knowledge and read this or do that. And there's a quiz or a workbook exercise to fill out of some kind. And they're to present that to you when they show up for the lesson because it proves out that they've done the work, right? Or guessed in line, it could be like that too. But at least I think you kind of know where they stand. It's gonna be hard to answer those questions if you really have not done this before. And so it holds everybody accountable. The issue we have with teaching with comprehensive ground lesson plans in an actual lesson is that those are designed to cover absolutely everything. And so the lesson on steep turns can take 20 minutes, 25 minutes to teach. Imagine the one in stalls is probably gonna take another 15. Then on the one stall, power off, power on, slow flight. So you're talking about maybe an hour and a half of briefings. Then the student, we haven't even done any ground yet. This is just briefings, right? And so you go like, well, this is kind of a lot here and it's a bit too detailed. So what I'm telling you to do is then in that particular, if the student hasn't done it, well, yes, then that's your comprehensive ground lesson. If the student has done it, then you can quiz them, go through the syllabus, and then give them the pre-flight briefing, right? Which is much shorter. It's in the order of like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 8 minutes, you know, per briefing. So you can get through a fair number of those, three or four, and then you can go right out to the airplane. It's fresh in their head, and then they can do it. So that's what I would say. So that's the idea for it, and that's why I wrote it in that way, because first we needed a comprehensive set of lesson plans, because you never know how the ground training was. And so you say, look, it doesn't seem like you really understand this maneuver very well. Pre-flight briefing is probably not going to do it. So let me give you the full-on briefing on this, and then let's see how the others go. Maybe the others are fine. So sometimes you have to call it that way. But your student needs to be showing up prepared. So you have a lot of community colleges and little academic places using our Teach Pre-Fly system, and they're using it and holding their students accountable, because when the student shows up not done, and they're not done their work, then there's no flight, usually. And then the parents call, and they're mad because their kid's not flying, the kid's mad, and say, well, he's not doing the work. And now we have a way, they've pretty much taken that book into their syllabus. And they say, this is just part of what you have to do. It's part of the completion standards. Before you show up, this is what you have to do. So now they're doing it, and evidently that's working out better. So that's that. So I'll let you look at that. That's on our website as well. It's on our online store. You can take a look at that. And the last thing I wanted to tell you about was, I know there are certain times when flight training can be a drag, or especially when you're in CFI flight training and you're having to memorize things, and that was a rote level knowledge, and then trying to get concepts and study the fundamentals of instructing and get that out of the way. And then as soon as you have studied that, you know, then aerodynamics has slipped and fallen on the wayside, and you've got to go review that, and endorsements, and you've got a lot to do. But when you need to take a break, I want you to go to YouTube, and I want you to look for a video. This video series. It's done by the U.S. Navy, and it was for flight training. And it was a very interesting thing they did. So it was called the let me think the name. I always get so the name of it's called Flight Sense, and it's a U.S. Navy primary flight training. Again, the link is in our newsletter. So if you're on our newsletter list, you get it. If not, you opt in. You're going to get it anyway. You'll get it as soon as it comes available. It's going to be this newsletter will be out in about, I think it's about another week yet or two. Actually, the first will be in September, so it'll be the first week of September. But in the meantime, you can go see this kind of thing. And there's two links in there, and it's Flying Sense, like I said. And this what happened was, the Navy wanted to create some training videos for their Yellow Peril, which is the Boeing Stearman, which is what they were using for primary training. And so they had this idea that they would film things, and they kind of made it sort of interesting. They have one character, I think his name is McFly or whatever, he's always screwing up, you know, always doing the bad things. Actually, they not destroyed, but they wrecked three steermen doing this thing, having him do some little antics that weren't necessarily dangerous, but they definitely had prop strikes and all these manner of things. But what the interesting thing part of this was, they had drafted a movie star, and his name was Robert Bob Taylor. He did about 80 movies. This is like in the 40s, World War II stuff, right? And what he did was, when they drafted him, I'm sure there's no real written record of this, but I'm sure this is kind of what they thought was like, okay, we can't let Robert Taylor go to combat, can we? You know, we're going to put him in as a, what are we going to do with him? And so they said, well, we'll make him a pilot, because that'll take a while, right? And so they did, and so they made him a pilot. Then the war wasn't over yet, of course. And I'm sure they went like, well, what are we going to do now? And they probably said, well, let's make him an instructor pilot. We can keep him in the States and go to combat, right? Okay. So he did that. And then what they thought afterwards was, wait, we've got Robert Taylor. Why don't we make these videos and let him be the star of the video and teach maneuvers and teach all the basic concepts of flying. And that's what they did. And it's an amazing series, because it explains things in very clear, easy to understand ways. They equated a lot to driving a car. They talk about coordination and how, you know, and the flight path of the airplane. And they also, for their time, they had some pretty sophisticated special effects for the time. Some of them you'd be like, well, we could even use those today. They're not bad whatsoever. And there's a lot of insight into what he says. He's got two cadets that he starts off with, and you'll see it when you see it. But basically, they're sitting in the briefing room, and he's basically saying that flying, you know, starts off with tunnel vision. He says you're focusing on what you're afraid of. He says, and then in the end, it opens up just like your car, everything else, and you see everything. You see everything in your entire periphery. And he's giving a lot of good advice. So that you can find on YouTube. Again, the guy's Robert Taylor, but it's called Flying Sense. And so when you're not doing something, pick one of those up and watch it. And that's pretty much what I've got for you. If you're not a member of Bootcamp Plus, which is free to you, by the way, go to our website under resources and join Bootcamp Plus, a basic membership. It gives you access to the podcast. It gives you access to all of our, some considerable number of our power hours, which are on every Saturday from 12 until 1. Those are live webinars. We do those, and there's always a good topic that's there. A lot of people show up for that. So you can join the, you can also opt into the power hours if you're not a member of that. And there's a lot of goodies that say in the basic membership. And then if you like it and you want more things, there's a way to, for a small amount of money to be able to go on further, but you never have to. So just saying, all that stuff is free to you. And we just like being connected to our people, our audience. And that's all I got for you this week. So here from Miami Beach, we got missed by Grace. That was a grace that we got missed. We got missed by Fred mostly, and we'll see who else comes down the line. But until 2 weeks from now, I will talk to you then. Bye-bye. And that is Flight Training the Way I See It. This has been a production of Flight Training the Way I See It. News, tips, and opinion.